second half of the afternoon. The volume is catching up with me. Second half, welcome back. It's a great pleasure to meet a new colleague, quite a discovery in the preparation for this symposium. Dr. Iona Heath is a real doctor, a GP with a real long history of practice in various parts of London, but she's a doctor with a difference, a doctor that reflects upon the social cultural implication of a practice, and particularly on the influence of pharmaceutical companies on the ways in which we deal with pain, suffering, and ways of dying. A very distinguished record, if I may say so, an elected member of the Royal College of GPs since 1989, chaired the College Ethics Committee still since till 2004, and several publications. I think the one that we'll hear the paper from tonight, Matters of Life and Death, is quite a collage and very, very interesting artistic practice of combining medically grounded remarks, clinical observations, with poetry and with philosophy and with endless wisdom about the necessity and in some ways the inevitability of caring. Please welcome Dr. Iona Heath. 30 minutes.
Quite how I can match the introduction, I'm not at all sure. When I agreed to come to do this, I wondered how I would fit in. And I am hugely grateful to Patrick because he has showed me how I can fit in. Because I've been in practice in one place in London, not several, just in one place, for more than 30 years. In that time, I've seen hundreds of people die. I have never come close to contact with someone even considering voluntary euthanasia. The voluntary euthanasia part is a tiny minority sport in the world of dying. So I'm an ordinary GP, and I'm here to talk about ordinary dying, because for me, it's a refusal to deal with the ordinary that makes it impossible for us then to deal with the extraordinary. And by concentrating on the extraordinary, it lets us, let's not kid ourselves, the ordinary, off the hook. So this is about the ordinary. And Rosie dropped me in it a bit and said I should talk a little bit about how I think. And I came across this wonderful word, which I actually can't pronounce. I'm sure Marina could. But I understand that it combines the Greek words for useful and learning. And what one of those is a collection of short quotations, and especially one that is compiled to help in the learning of a language. And what I've been doing over the past few years is constructing my own personal annotated one of those for the language of dying that makes sense in the context of my work as a general practitioner. I've been exploring the extent to which the words of poets and writers and thinkers illuminate the struggles of ordinary people and the details of lives and deaths, which are always in some measure extraordinary, but not as Patrick was talking. Now, this is my first contributor to my Cresto Mathi. I'm presuming that's how you say it. And you know, it's Saturday afternoon, we need to talk about football. I'm surprised it hasn't been mentioned so far. This is, as all of you will know, Bill Shankly, the legendary manager of Liverpool Football Club, whose most renowned statement starts as this. Is everybody able to read my slides? Because I don't intend to read them for you. Okay, that's how he started, and this is how he continued. Quintessential Shankly. I also subscribe to it wholeheartedly. What it's underlining is that what we do with our lives, it's much more important than when we die. So my thesis is that within contemporary society, we have lost sight of the extent to which how we live, what we do, is more important than when we die. 56 million people die in the world every year, about. And you know, if you add in the global activities of certain world leaders, you increase the number probably. But even if each of those deaths affects only 5 other people, the total number affected each year approaches 300 million, and that's 1 in 20 of the world's population. So dying permeates living. Yet much of the response to death and dying, at least in richer countries, remains polarized between sensationalism and silence. The public discourse about death has become profoundly inadequate. I'm going to try section my talk under these titles, and I'm going to start with the denial of death. And I want to tell you the story about an elderly woman patient of mine. She was a wonderful old lady, and she taught me that flowers last longer if you keep them in fizzy lemonade. I tried it for a while, but it is very sticky. I do think they do last longer, but it is very sticky. Anyway, some years ago, she was living in sheltered accommodation. She made the mistake of collapsing. So the warden very kindly called an ambulance, the way you would. She was in her late 80s, and she was a widow, and she was very frail. And at that time, there was one of the recurrent furores over ageism in medicine. And perhaps as a result, she was admitted to a coronary care unit, and she received the highest possible standard of care, what we describe as the highest possible standard. So she had her clot busted, and she was on an intensive care unit. And she made an excellent recovery, and she was discharged home a week later. And I went to see her, and I found her very grateful in the way old people are for the care and attention that she'd be given. But she was profoundly shocked by a course of treatment that she perceived to be completely inappropriate. And she told me that not only her husband, but almost her entire generation of friends had already died, that her physical frailty prevented her from doing almost everything she enjoyed, and that she had no desire to live much longer. No one had asked her about any of this, or attempted to discover whether the effective and therefore the recommended treatment for her condition was appropriate in her particular case. She died 3 weeks later in her sleep, and the considerable costs of her earlier treatment had been futile, distressing, and wasteful. As a general practitioner, I am conscious of failing many of my patients, and none more so than those who are dying. Why is it that so few people die what would be recognized or described as a good death? What indeed is a good death? What manner of dying do we want for ourselves and those we love? Talking to my colleagues, I discover that many of us are able to describe our involvement in one or two special deaths, where the dying person seems able to control and orchestrate the process, and to die with a dignity and a calm which left everyone around them, the doctor including, feeling privileged to have been involved. I disagree with Patrick. I have seen dignity in dying, and it is entirely possible. And it is very interesting for me that we talk about control and dignity in relation to assisted suicide, but we do not discuss or even think about the degree to which control and dignity, that it is possible to self-fashion your death as an individual exerting free will. It's a very powerful thing. And what is striking for me is how rare those deaths are. So many more are bungled and undignified, marked by overwhelming fear or suffering or both, and leaving those remaining, again including the doctor, with feelings of anger, guilt, and sorrow. And what goes wrong? I'm a familiar of death. I'm a doctor, I'm a familiar of death. The problem with this is that over the last 100 years, the spectacular success of scientific medicine has allowed doctors to turn away from this traditional role of being the familiar of death. The technological challenge of prolonging life has gradually taken priority over the quality of the life lived. And by dangerous and insidious processes, we have lost sight of the extent to which how we live matters more. And perversely, nowhere is this clearer than in the care of the dying. I love this cartoon. The hubris of scientific medicine fuels ever-increasing public expectations of perfect health and consistent longevity, and these processes are eagerly exploited by both journalists and politicians, and most of all by the pharmaceutical industry. The aim of healthcare and the end point against which it is evaluated has become, to a very great extent, the simple prolongation of life. We talk all the time about preventable death, as if death could ever be prevented rather than simply postponed. We indulge in activities and restraints that we suppose will make us live longer, and the timeliness of many deaths seems never to be discussed. The huge amount of money that can be made from preventive technologies has diminished the economic importance of treatment technologies, particularly for those illnesses that primarily affect poor people in poor countries. The pharmaceutical industry now invests much more in selling remedies to keep you and I, the rich people of the world, to prevent us getting ill than in treating poorer people who are already sick. So there's been a shift of attention from the sick to the well and from the poor to the rich, both globally and locally. Human societies are and have always been riven by the effects of greed and fear. The rise of preventive health technologies has opened up a new arena of human greed, which responds to an ever-enduring fear. The greed is for ever greater longevity, the fear is that of dying. The irony is, and the tragedy is, that the greed inflates the fear and poisons the present in the name of a better, or at least a longer future. Chesterton's usually on the mark. An obsession with health is destructive of it. The more people are exposed to the machinations of contemporary healthcare, the more they perceive themselves to be sick and at risk, and the higher the rates of self-reported illness. Current standards of healthcare, as came clear in my story of my patient, are dictated more and more by what is described as evidence-based, very narrow definition of evidence in my view, protocols which are supposed to ensure quality, but which by their nature regard patients as standardized units of disease. Such protocols have no way of accommodating the unique story of the individual, the particular values, aspirations, and priorities of each different person, and the way that these shift over time. As a direct result, a rational, evidence-based intervention of proven efficacy can turn out to be inappropriate, wasteful, and futile. Contemporary affluent societies collude in what Philip Larkin described as this. And the cost is not just monetary. It's also one which takes deep toll of our experience of both living and dying. Despite the expensive pretensions of medicine, death remains the inevitable end of life and is often unpredictable, arbitrary, and unjust, and yet is seen more and more as a simple failure of medicine and doctors. Medicine cannot promise the relief of all bodily discomfort and pain, yet we become ever less tolerant of these and ever more convinced that we have a right to perfect health. Scientists and doctors, but also journalists and politicians, carry a great responsibility for perpetuating these dangerous illusions, which serve to further damage, demoralize, stigmatize, and disappoint the dying. And not only the dying, but those suffering from chronic diseases that can be treated but not cured. The continual emphasis on lifestyle risk factors for disease creates a climate of victim blaming, which adds a sense of guilt to the distress and terror suffered by those arbitrarily afflicted by serious disease. We all try to make sense of our lives by constructing a coherent narrative which includes notions of cause and effect. We want to believe that if we behave well, eat the right foods, in moderation, exercise regularly, and so on, we will be rewarded with a long and healthy life. But it ain't necessarily so, and Arthur Kleinman reminds us of this. And doctors also pay a heavy price for Larkin's costly aversion. Feeling themselves blamed for every death, they are driven by a sense of guilt and unease to struggle more and more for the prolongation of life, often at the expense of its quality. Whatever doctor thought it was a good idea to put that man on a ventilator, frankly needs some re-education. I mean, those sorts of illnesses are meant to kill you when you can no longer breathe. That is a medically induced torture, and the post hoc argument is not the relevant one. And this, you know, this is, I don't know how many of you saw this picture in the Sunday Colour supplements last week. This part of Annie Leibovitz's very loving series of photographs of the dead and dying Susan Sontag. But I looked at this picture and I thought, what the hell did she have an IV in her arm that late that it left that degree of bruising when she died? That is not care of the dying. And a study of the care of patients with either advanced cancer, which she had, or advanced dementia, perhaps even worse, dying in an acute hospital in the US, revealed that for 24%, that's one in four, of each group, cardiopulmonary resuscitation was attempted. And 55% of those with dementia died with feeding tubes in place. The truth is this. And Scott Murray and his colleagues in Edinburgh have used qualitative research techniques to compare the experience of dying in richer and poorer countries. And they found that while patients in Kenya describe their desire to die in order to be free of pain, patients in Scotland describe wanting to die because of the side effects of medical treatment. And this seems to me to be a terrible indictment of medical care. The proportion who actively want to die at any one moment is roughly the same. So I'm arguing that the hubris of biomedical science is in large part responsible for the dangerous and damaging denial of death within contemporary society. This is Christopher Ricks describing Beckett. And it seems that ordinary people are more and more aware of the nightmare, particularly as they grow older, and have made clear their awareness through their enthusiastic adoption of advanced directives and living wills, and even, I think, the public debate on euthanasia. But you must remember that this is a very small minority of deaths where they are ever invoked. So just to move on to the gift of death. Contemporary society seems to have lost all sense of the value of death, of the indissoluble linking of death to life and of death as integral to life. And the 17th century physician was very clear. Sir Thomas Browne, we are happier in death than we should have been without it. Because paradoxically, it is death that gives us time and its passing, without which we would be lost in a welter of eternity with no reason ever to act or indeed to live. Because without death, there's no time, there's no growth, and there's no change. In his wonderful poem, Mr. Cogito and Longevity by Zbigniew Herbert, he writes about his fear of immortality. And Mr. Cogito is Herbert's, I'm sure most of you know, alter ego. He goes on, with the care of a good gardener, he cultivates the wrinkles on his face, humbly accepts calcium deposited in his veins. He is delighted by lapses of memory. He was tormented by memory. Immortality since childhood put him in a state of trembling fear. And it finishes. And it's no coincidence that the contemporary denial of death has been accompanied by a valuing of the length of life over its intensity. If we avert our eyes from death, we also erode the delight of living. The less we sense death, the less we live. The central human endeavor is to find meaning in life and to construct a coherent life story which makes sense of experience. Walter Benjamin wrote, and what is really interesting is that the processes by which we have lost sight of the importance and value of death have in a similar way transformed suicide from a human right into a preventable disease. Suicide, and I'm not talking about assisted suicide, suicide is now held to be the fault of doctors in general and mental health doctors in particular. And undoubtedly, some suicide can be prevented by psychiatric care, and almost certainly much more by the more equitable distribution of hope and opportunity within society. But nonetheless, suicide remains a human right. And what is extraordinary is that assisted suicide is invoked as a human right, whereas ordinary suicide is relegated to a mental illness. Very odd public discourse there that I haven't got my head around yet. More than three centuries ago, Sir Thomas Brown understood this. And in If This Is a Man, Primo Levi explained with beautiful clarity one of the great gifts of death. It may curtail our joys, but it also sets limits to our misery. Yeah, this is Samuel Beckett saying roughly the same thing. And there's another wonderful bit of Beckett where he says this. I find this deeply, deeply comforting. This big note says check time. I think I'm doing well. So to come on to ways of dying, there's a view that a sudden death is easier for the one who dies, although tougher for those left behind, whereas the reverse is thought to be true for a slower and more protracted death. But I wonder whether on closer examination this is just another manifestation of the contemporary denial of death. The belief that a sudden death is better for the one who dies is one that attaches no value to the opportunities provided by a final illness. These include the chance to leave one's affairs in order, to contribute to the planning of one's funeral, to share and relive memories, to say farewell, to give and seek forgiveness, and to say the things which should be said. Because while there's time, there are always things which should be said. This went into my annotated personal collection after a visit to the Tate Modern, whereas this was attributed to both Matisse and Picasso, which I found really rather underlined the fact that they would needed to talk to each other. Dying gives us an opportunity to make life whole. A sudden death is oddly unfinished, and it is perhaps this sense of incompleteness which adds to the distress of those left behind. Because dying is an integral part of living and part of the story of a life. It's the last chance to find meaning and to make coherent sense of what has gone before. Because finding meaning in the story of a life is an act of creation. Wonderful Irish fact from a wonderful Irish writer. Meaning is constructed from memory and imagination. Each day, each of us selects and makes explicit perceptions from the myriad of sensations, thoughts, and feelings that are experienced. These perceptions become fixed in the memory and are used to create the story of that day and cumulatively the story of a life. Coherence, dignity, and meaning within the accumulated story make it possible for the protagonist to die. So the dignity is not necessarily in the dying, but there must be dignity in the story. Because if there's dignity in the story, then it's possible to die with a sense of worth and achievement. And this perhaps explains the significance of retelling and reliving important events at the end of life, and the very real comfort that can be realized for both the dying person and those who will be left behind by talking through past events and by looking again at shared photographs. Relatives and friends can continue the narrative even after the person is too weak to contribute, and in so doing, give comfort to everyone. What we need perhaps is a secular version of shriving, the old ritual of hearing confession, imposing a penance, and granting absolution. Because this could provide the opportunity to review a life and to make an account, to salve bad memories and allow for expressions of remorse and forgiveness. The giving of short shrift, cutting off any sense of the wholeness of a life, has become endemic, and both living and dying are the poorer for it. With the demise of formal religion of any colour, we have also lost ritual. And in a secular age, the challenge in this temple of culture is surely to find ways in which secular art and music can contribute to secular ritual and provide a context within which people can live their dying, as sacred art and music have done for those before us. So this is wanting to underline that dying is part of living, not part of death. It's got to be lived. And again, I invoke Samuel Beckett. I must just tell you about reading Samuel Beckett. There are lots of young people in the audience here. I read Malone Dies when I was 19 years old. And I can tell that because I wrote my name in the front. And I remember thinking it was a very great book. When I read it again when I was over 50, I realized for the first time that it's an extremely funny book. Now, that's a bit alarming that you can read a book when you're young and not even realize it's meant to be funny, and then realize again and realize it's hilarious. And it's probably that I was very illiterate when I read it the first time, but maybe you just have to be a bit ancient to realize how really funny it is. It's difficult to die. The transition from a strong, healthy body to one capable of slipping gently away into death is hard. Unless it's the result of a sudden and overwhelming catastrophe, the transition cannot be achieved without experience fatigue and weakness and other physical symptoms of debility and decline. The much-cited ambition that medical care should enable people to die symptom-free seems to me to be both unattainable and dangerously dishonest. By implying that dying can be detached from suffering, medicine makes a false promise and devalues as somehow obsolete and unnecessary the age-old human endeavor of facing pain and suffering with fortitude and stoicism. And this seems to me, after a long time in practice, a very serious error. Will, desire, and aspiration are all frustrated by the body's betrayal, and yet strength must be found to reconcile mind and imagination to the finality, the irreversibility, and the ultimate loneliness of death. Living always has a future, even while dying. And it is important that hope, however constrained and limited, is nurtured, although there's a delicate balance to be struck between the ultimately painful deceit of false hope and the genuine hope, albeit confined to a very limited present, of a better moment, a sunny day, a birthday, or a loving contact. There is something quite extraordinary about the way the human mind and spirit adapts to the slow erosion of the body by aging or disease, constantly adjusting to altered circumstance, but remaining largely unchanged with undiminished aspirations and hopes. But my patients have also shown me that in dying, the time and of time of the body and the time of the mind often become disconnected. So some patients have bodies that fail well before the mind is ready to die, and that exacerbates the fear and anger involved. Others are reconciled and ready in their minds to die long before the body is capable of dying. At its worst, this latter predicament can lead to suicide or requests for euthanasia. But it seems to me that one of the tasks of medical care is to try and bring the two times into as close a harmony as possible, and that pain and suffering, paradoxically or not, have an essential part to play in this process. Now, while I'm very cognizant of the dangers of romanticizing pain, I wonder whether it's possible that pain is not the unmitigated evil dictated by the conventions of palliative care. Could it be that the presence of pain reduces frustration and anger because pain and suffering in some way help the sufferer to become reconciled to death? Just a little aside, this is a series of quite wonderful pictures by the New Zealand artist Trevor Moffat, who did this fantastic sequence of his father from when he was quite a young man. The first picture I ever saw in the series is a fantastic picture of this huge man leaning into the frame of the picture with his finger up saying, "No son of mine goes to university." That's the beginning of the sequence. But it seems that all the things that we fight against, illness, pain, and aging, are in some strange way the things that make it possible to die. And there seem to me to be parallels with pregnancy, for those of you who've been there. When the gradual onset of the indignities and physical discomforts of late pregnancy make the difficulties, demands, and sleeplessness of looking after a tiny baby seem an improvement in life's condition. And one of the things that needs to be emphasized when someone is given a fatal diagnosis is that you will not die until your body is ready to die, until it reaches the point when it actually wants to die, provided, of course, medicine, technology, and revolting things like that don't get in the way. This is 1725, Japanese death poem. And this is true. This I've seen this happen so often. Spinoza's theory of, it's the closest I get to being a serious philosopher, I can mention Spinoza. Spinoza's theory of, Spinoza and Shankly in the same talk, I'm quite proud of that. Spinoza's theory of parallelism maintained that this, and this seems to me to suggest that the sickness of the body serves to attune the mind to the necessity of death. Sense-making and the finding of meaning and the summation of a life within a coherent story are processes through which the mind becomes accepting of death. Connections of love and acquaintance and relationship are crucial to this endeavor. There's evidence to suggest that patients, you know, biomedical journal sort of evidence, to suggest that patients living in traditional communities in poorer countries have many more physical needs, unmet physical needs, but fewer unmet, what are unpleasantly described as psychosocial needs, than patients living in rich countries. Because the professionalization of palliative care and the consequent medicalization of death seems to have de-skilled and disempowered families and friends so that they are no longer able to accommodate the distress of the dying. We've forgotten how to do it. Ways need to be found for richer countries to learn from poorer ones, while at the same time improving the physical care of dying patients in poorer countries without damaging the very real support currently provided by family and community. This is Dad again, after his mum died. Human lives span past, present, and future. And during his last illness, a friend once told me that his past seemed a failure, his future almost non-existent, and he was trapped in the misery of the present. And the response must be not only to try and reduce the distress of the present, but also to take an inventory of the past, to explore memory, to tell a story of achievement, to say explicitly and repeatedly all the precious things that too often are only said at funerals. And doctors need to find a way of being a useful part of this necessary exploration without intruding, and without assuming understanding where there is none Again, I give you Beckett. Fabulous description of doctors. Fact is, they don't know, neither do I, but they think they know. A destructive intrusion into the delicate balance that constitutes a good dying can also be physical and more obviously medical. Look at the date of that. That's 1951. Now, how much truer has it become over the intervening years? Was anybody listening? Medicine has not learnt when to stop. And it hasn't learnt when to stop because it perceives that people don't want it to learn when to stop. It's very difficult to identify the moment when the pursuit of improvement in a patient's condition has become futile and it's time to switch from treatment to comfort. It's sometimes easier with cancer when patients and those who love them are often expecting deterioration. But it's much harder with those who are gently losing a battle against an accumulation of chronic diseases, especially when they are old and frail. Yet old people often help doctors by saying, if they are given the chance, that they do not wish to struggle any further. But it's often harder for those who will be left behind to accept this kind of giving up. And the German philosopher Hans-Georg Gadamer, who died in 2002 at the incredible age of 102, and it's perhaps not surprising that he'd thought rather deeply about death and dying, had rather a lot of time to do it. And again, I want to give you an obstetric parallel, because I wonder whether that at the beginning of the 21st century, our care of the dying is at the point where obstetrics was, when women were at last offered effective pain relief, but before they reclaimed the right to choose whether or not they wanted it, or whether they wanted to try other ways of coping and living with pain. We use painkillers and we relieve a lot of suffering, but we also anesthetize people so that they do not feel death, and so have no way of making sense of it. And in so doing, perhaps, I'm only asking questions, we devalue the life which is so inextricably bound to it. A medical death can become almost as truncated as a violent one. In War and Peace, Tolstoy describes death and dying in a time before modern pharmacology, in all its horror. But he also explores systematically the inverse relationship between free will and inevitability. And maybe that by using painkillers and sedation, we suffocate any possibility of freedom in death, and so emphasize only its inevitability. And that was all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
I was off.
Sorry. You can't sit down yet.
Good afternoon, Anne. I'd like to ask you a question in relation to a statement that you made, and that was the self-fashioning of death as an individual. Could you please explain that?
Well, you know, To link back to Marina and voodoo, you know, if the voodoo doctor says that the patient's going to die, even when conventional medicine can find nothing wrong with the patient dies. There's an extraordinary power in meaning, both constructive and destructive. And those deaths that all of us as doctors have seen, where the person who is dying times it, people who hold on till somebody comes or to somebody's birthday, and then die just like that. I have been summoned on one or two occasions by a patient who wants me to come and say goodbye. I've only realized afterwards that's what's going on because I'm a bit slow. But it's quite clear that some people can do it. Now, we don't ever talk about that. If some people can do it, more of us can do it. if we talked about it and if we were given the freedom to think we might. And I really do think there are parallels with childbirth, where, you know, when it was originally medicalized, you just became a body as a machine that's going to be a pusher, and that nothing else really mattered. And then we learned it a completely different way.
Thank you for a wonderful and moving lecture. I was also wondering, you talked about the denial of death, which I do think is very, very persistent in our culture. I'm working on popular culture, and I'm also very fascinated by the fear of old age, as if, you know, the fear of death is moving more and more and more and more into life forever. Fading and, yeah, pushing away, as if we're forever pushing away old age and life. And I read a beautiful sentence this week in a Dutch newspaper, I actually forgot who said it, who said, we all want to become old, but none of us wants to be old. And I think that is so very, very true, that, you know, on the one hand, we're very scared of dying and want to become old. At the same time, in our culture, we're also becoming so very, very afraid of being old, up to the point of what I sometimes think is almost absurdity. If you look at, you know, cosmetic surgery, the sort of training of the body, in a way becoming physically almost the robots and zombies that Marina was talking about this morning. Can you comment on that?
Well,
how
again,
you see that in your practice?
Again, I would want to emphasize the ordinary. And that I would want to emphasize the ordinary. And that the vast majority of people get old without plastic surgery, still, even today. But it is one of the things my patients say as they go out the door, don't get old, dear. To which I reply, well, I suspect at the moment it may be better than the alternative, if you see what I mean. But I think the here I get on my pharmaceutical company rant, because I think the pharmaceutical companies are really responsible for infecting life with fear. And there is this, I just tell you about this study, because the author of this study is staying at my house at the moment, but this is a wonderful study. The European Society Guidelines of Preventing Heart Disease, okay? They say, this is all technical, but they say you should treat a cholesterol level over 5, and you should treat a blood pressure over 150 over 90, and you should make no allowance of how old the person is. So even if they're 90, you should get on it. Well, you shouldn't necessarily, they have a caveat, you shouldn't necessarily treat these people with a drug, but you should tell them that they're increased risk of dying of heart disease, so that they are able to make the necessary lifestyle adjustments. You should tell them. Okay, so these wonderful researchers in Norway had this data for an entire population of a huge county of Norway, 20,000 people or something. So they applied this data to the whole population, and I kid you not, the rate of abnormality in this population, which is one of the longest living in history, of course, Norway, reached 50% at the age of 24. Okay? So 50% of 24-year-olds in Norway, who are actually going to live to over 89, I think it is, are at increased risk of premature death. Someone is kidding someone. Okay? So... And that is current cardiology guidelines. The world has run crazy.
May I ask a question? I was wondering in your talk. I mean, I had the kind of. Benefit of talking to you over lunch, and we discussed some other things, including, let's say, organized religion and spirituality. So I'm just wondering, on the one hand, what your view is on questions of death in relation to organized religion, organized spirituality, and on the other hand, arts and culture in general, particularly with reference to those examples that you used in your talk.
Well, I don't have any take on formal religion, though I do see formal religion clearly giving significant comfort to some of my patients. It's not going to comfort me, but what is going to comfort me is it's Pasternak who says that God is history, and that eternity is memory and imagination, and all the so I think that art has a huge contribution to make in putting the living in touch with the eternal, and particularly to put the dying in touch with the eternal. There's a wonderful bit of John Berger where he says, if music is the pulse of time, eternity is the spaces in between. I pastiche terribly, but eternity is the spaces in between. He says something like that. And I think that that, again, is beautiful. And this picture of Susan Sontag, she should not have, that's music, candles, holding hands time. That's not needles in the arm time. That's terrible. And if even she got that, she deserved it.
Can I run one more question, I fear. Yeah.
I'm actually dying. I have secondary bone, liver, and lung. And I found this wonderful. Thank you. You did talk about, I think this is right, pain may be necessary as an important part of expressing anger. Am I right? I'm just very interested in.
I didn't quite put it like that, and I don't think that's what I mean. The two things to say. Michael Young, when he interviewed dying people in the East End, a book called A Good Death, a lot of his people that he spoke to valued pain in a way as being a way that you could actually tell you were still alive. Pain as part of making sense of the process, and therefore actually leeching some of the anger out of the situation, perhaps, that it's, it's André in War and Peace. It's this beautiful man who is going to die, and for the first two-thirds of the book, you want André to live. And then you get the description of how much he's suffering, and the reader no longer wants him to survive, because it's how very clever nature is in reconciling bodies to change. And I think medicine tramples over that cleverness sometimes without thinking about what it's altering. Now, I am not saying that people shouldn't have painkillers, but I think people should be able to choose what painkillers they have, when they have them, and that there's nothing bad about not having them. And again, the whole palliative care movement that grew up from Dame Cicely Saunders, hugely charismatic person, a wonderful ability to communicate with dying people. And actually, we've now reached a stage that you roll it out and it becomes implemented by people who've had a training and actually sometimes can do nothing more than double the opiate dose when they're confronted with somebody who's suffering. It's not necessarily about pain. Pain and suffering are not always the same thing. That's what I think I'm saying.
Thank you.
Not sure I'm making any sense.